On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Dr. Dean Radin about his new book, Supernormal: Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities.
These yogic traditions don't point to supernormal powers. That's not what they're about. And in fact, they go to great lengths to say, hey, it's not about these supernormal powers. Don't worry about them. If we're not willing to tackle the divine, we're kind of playing a different game, but are we playing the game?
It's true that the yogic path and many of these other mystical paths are basically pointing to enlightenment. Enlightenment is so far away from where science is that it's probably too far a reach for now. And it's also true that these traditions say you're going to bump into these psychic things and don't pay attention to them because they're just yardsticks on the way to something more interesting. Well, we're in the modern age now. And what science is able to do is study not the depths of enlightenment, but we certainly can study the very place where mind and matter meet. It's where the deep subjective and deep objective meet, and that is psychic phenomena. If we're interested in the nature of consciousness, we need to expand it to exactly in the place where the yogis said don't pay much attention to.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, Dean Radin returns to Skeptico to talk about his new book, Supernormal. When we did the special 200th episode of Skeptico, the guest that folks said they most wanted to hear from again was Dr. Dean Radin. So with his new book coming out, I thought it was a great opportunity to reconnect Dr. Radin to all of us on Skeptico. Here's my interview with Dr. Dean Radin. Today we welcome Dr. Dean Radin to Skeptico. He's here to talk about his new book, Supernormal: Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. Dr. Radin, of course, is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where he's become one of the world's best-known researchers on extended human consciousness. His two previous books, The Conscious Universe and Entangled Minds, were truly groundbreaking and provide the scientific foundation for much of the current interest there is in this field. Dr. Radin, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So a lot of people are very excited about this new book of yours, Supernormal. Can you start just by telling us briefly what it's about?
Well, one way of getting into the topic is that you may know that the Dalai Lama for years now has been having dialogues with scientists on the relationship between Buddhist ideas and practice and science, both primarily physics and the neurosciences. And one of the things that you see when you read the transcripts of what goes on in these meetings, and of course they've spawned a number of popular books as well, is that the Dalai Lama is very interested in science and the practice of science and what science has discovered. And he has said many times that if science demonstrates that something about Buddhist practice or beliefs are incorrect, that they'll change their beliefs and practices. They're after the truth. So that's laudable. And you would hope then that the same would be true on the scientific side, that if some scientific assumptions turn out not to be completely correct, that scientists will correct them as well. But after reading the transcripts, you see that what we're dealing with is an asymmetry, that there's a lot of interest on the part of the Buddhists on what science has to say, but there's so far very little interest on part of science on what Buddhism has to say. And you see this in stark contrast when the Dalai Lama repeatedly tries to bring up issues about reincarnation and about the use of the oracle and other things that we might consider to be psychic phenomena or related to that. And the scientists present usually know nothing about these topics, and they dismiss them. They dismiss them in a kind and gentle way so they don't piss off the Dalai Lama, But nevertheless, they say there's no evidence. We can now go on to other topics. And this is, I was just struck with this because, for one thing, it really shows that the people that are talking to the Dalai Lama are very straightforward, mainstream, very good at what they do, but they don't actually know what they're talking about when they dismiss these topics. And in almost every meeting, either the Dalai Lama or somebody else at the meeting will try to raise, well, what about telepathy? What about these issues? And it doesn't go anywhere. So I was becoming annoyed at watching this year after year, and I decided to write a book that looked in more detail at the origins of, why does the Dalai Lama and other people say these things, and what's wrong with science?
Let's narrow that down a little bit, because the title supernormal is kind of a nebulous term. Specifically, Dean, what are you including in that list of supernormal powers in your book, and what did you maybe leave out that could have been left in?
Well, I'm making a distinction between supernormal and supernatural. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see these words used synonymously, and they're really not. Supernatural means beyond the natural world, and it generally means that it's something we would consider to be divine, not of the natural world, above and beyond it in some way. Whereas supernormal is ordinary, normal stuff, but just super, bigger, more powerful, more enhanced in some way. And so I'm not intruding into the world of the divine, because I wouldn't know how to study that anyway, but I can look in detail at normal abilities that are super in some way. And there's a similar distinction between the words miracle and marvel. The word miracle assumes a divine source. Something happens that cannot be explained through natural means. Whereas a marvel is something that's extraordinary. So the subtitle of the book is Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. And that then is the boundary of what I'm looking at.
So tell us a little bit about some of those extraordinary abilities you look at in this book.
Well, I use yoga and the siddhis, which is a Sanskrit word meaning perfection or attainment, which is what is said to occur after advanced meditative practice. And these are the special abilities that happen, and they're almost all psychic abilities. I use that path, the yogic path, and I could have used many others, and I do mention them, but I use the yoga path because it sets out so clearly what the tradition is in meditative traditions on what kinds of psychic ability you would expect to bump into as a result of practice. And they fall into three classes. There's a class that is exceptional mind-body connections. These are everything from intensely powerful self-healing, like take the placebo effect and multiply it by a few thousand times, to much more radical claims having to do with anedia, which is, in other words, called breatharianism, where you don't have to eat anything and you apparently live perfectly well, to effects which kind of blur the distinction between mind matter and body stuff. And this includes levitation. It's the lightening of your body until you begin to hover and perhaps even fly. And the opposite of levitation, which is gravitation, in which you become extremely heavy. And then there's super speed and super strength and the whole array of things we associate with superheroes. These are mostly body-related stuff. Then there's another big class of clairvoyance in the Yoga Sutras, which is the classical yoga text. The way that it's described are roughly 20 different forms of clairvoyance, but they all devolve down to the idea that we have access to information that's either at a distance or hidden, or very small or very big that you wouldn't normally be able to see. And then a smaller class on direct mind-matter interactions, in which through thought, things will manifest. So you wish to have a diamond, and the diamond appears, that kind of thing. So I discuss the full range, but in discussing it, I also make very clear that because this is a investigation from a scientific perspective, I can really only discuss with any confidence things that have been studied in the laboratory for many decades and has been looked at repeatedly, and that we gain some reason to believe that the effects are real. So it really comes down to about four different classes of experiments in which we have very high confidence that some of the original concepts of the cities, these special powers, are true. And if those are true, then it raises the plausibility that some of the other things that have been described, including levitation and invisibility and all the rest, that some of that may not be completely fairy tales. Even though we don't have good evidence for it today, maybe at some time it did exist, or maybe we have the potential to see those things.
Right, because as you point out, those things are talked about in a very matter-of-fact way in not only the ancient Hindu and yogic texts, but in contemporary accounts of people's encounters with various yoga masters, right?
That's right.
So obviously your book, you're making frequent references to the yogic tradition and meditation. What are your personal experiences with yoga and meditation, both before the book and during the research and the writing of the book?
Well, I've done yoga one form or another for many years, not for the past couple of years as seriously as I had in the past. And I've also done meditation on and off for over 40 years. But when I decided to write a book on this topic, and I looked at the research that is coming out now, both on yoga and meditation, the mental and physical benefits of meditation, I decided it would basically be stupid not to meditate. It would be stupid in the same sense that it would be stupid not to brush your teeth every day. That as a daily practice that you simply do because it's the right thing to do, you have to meditate. Now, this doesn't mean that some people are just naturally inclined, either through temperament or genetic inheritance, that they're very calm and controlled in a sense that they're not tightly controlled, but they don't worry about things. They're not anxious. They're just a calm people. For a person like that, they probably don't need to meditate too much, because the stress of the modern age is the disease of the modern age is stress. And so if you don't find a way to easily control that or do something about stress, it will eat you alive. And I tend to be wired tight. Naturally, I'm a high anxious person, and I can tell a dramatic difference when I'm meditating versus not, just in the way that I feel and how I sleep and all the other things related to going about your daily life. So the combination of my past experience with meditation and also taking what I've written in this book seriously, I decided, okay, I really got to do this. So I have a meditation practice I do twice a day now, and have done every single day for the last 2 years, and I plan on continuing it because it primarily just makes me feel a lot better. But having read all of the rest of the scientific evidence and a lot about the yogic lore, it may go beyond that as well.
Mm-hmm. In the introduction to Supernormal, you talk about the empirical scientific evidence for these things being overwhelming. And you suggest that it's an opportunity for science to pull itself up by its bootstraps. Tell us what you mean by that, particularly the pull itself up by the bootstraps. Why does science need to pull itself up by the bootstraps?
Well, of course, the phrase means that in order to make an advancement, a major advancement, sometimes you can pull yourself up by the rungs of a ladder. This is the evolutionary step-by-step pulling in a predictable sequence. Pulling yourself up by bootstraps is almost paradoxical because you're pulling yourself up from the bottom. Well, how can you do that? And you can't do that in the real world, but the concept is that that you sometimes need to make a leap of faith, essentially, based on evidence that comes out of your tradition. It's like suddenly there's another ladder that appears next to you. Instead of taking the evolutionary step up your ladder, you'll say, well, maybe there's a ladder there that works too. So in this case, it means there's a very long tradition, much longer than the scientific tradition, that is not only in yoga, but in many other paths as well, that basically all say the same thing, that if you sit down, you quiet your mind, you pay attention to what's going on deeply subjectively, then whole new worlds appear. Now, the caution here is that psychologists in the last century spent a fair amount of time with introspection and trying to figure out how does the mind work by introspecting. And they didn't get very far with that. And I would say that that has dampened enthusiasm in psychology for the idea that you could learn something about the mind and maybe beyond the mind simply by paying attention to what's going on inside your head, except that the means by which psychologists were using introspection was not the same as what meditators do. And so if you follow the original meditative traditions, and of course there are dozens of different meditative styles, and which may lead to different insights, but if you follow those traditions, you find somewhere at the bottom, meaning advanced practice, that they begin to converge in a worldview. And that worldview is something that science knows very little about. Probably the deepest look into there at this point has been cyber research, because we're looking at this boundary between mind and matter, and that's kind of where these deep meditative practices begin to diverge from what scientific assumptions would say about the nature of reality. And so what can science learn then about deep subjectivity? I think it has a lot to learn. In the same way that science has learned a lot more about deep objectivity than the meditative traditions have, we have something to learn from that tradition as well.
Okay, but doesn't science require a kind of closed-loop system that you're exploding both in this book and in your previous books? And if, as you're hinting at, again, in this book and in your previous books, the consciousness is somehow fundamental, then why or how can we possibly get there with a science that's centered around measuring matter? I mean, is it realistic to pull yourself up by the bootstraps when there's that kind of huge paradigm shift that has to take place?
Well, when you pull yourself up from your bootstraps, it does require different assumptions and perhaps different methods. But science is good at that. Science has developed new methods as new challenges come along. In fact, if we didn't develop new instruments and new methods, we wouldn't have gotten very far. So the nice thing about science as an open system is that it is flexible and basically limited primarily by our imagination. Ultimately, the proof in the pudding is whether people can repeat things independently. But the means by which we get to that stage is not fixed.
Okay, but I still wonder if, you know, we're kind of nibbling around at the edges of something that we have to swallow whole. I mean, as you mentioned in the book and you mentioned previously in this interview, these yogic traditions don't point to supernormal powers. That's not what they're about. And in fact, they go to great lengths to say, hey, it's not about these supernormal powers. Don't worry about them. It's about changing your connection and how you relate to, for lack of a better word, God. If we're not willing to tackle the divine, if we throw up our hands and say we can't measure the divine, then we're kind of playing a different game. But are we playing the game? You know, are we just playing some sideshow game over here?
That's a very good point. So it's true that the yogic path and many of these other mystical paths are basically pointing to enlightenment. Enlightenment is so far away from where science is that it's probably too far a reach for now. And it's also true that these traditions say you're going to bump into these psychic things and don't pay attention to them because they're just yardsticks on the way to something more interesting. I would say that from the ancient traditions, that advice was probably sound. that, you know, don't pay much attention to these strange phenomena because that's not where you want to go. Well, we're in the modern age now, and what science is able to do is study not the depths of enlightenment, but we certainly can study the very place where mind and matter meet. It's where the deep subjective and deep objective meet, and that is psychic phenomena. So the reason why the book is an entree into that says, you know what, science, we don't know yet as scientists how to go all the way down to or all the way up to the enlightenment, but we can begin to go much, much deeper than we have before. And in the process of studying the very area, that very boundary that the ancients would say don't pay attention to, well, we have to pay attention to that. Because if we ignore it as well, we'll never get anywhere. I mean, you know, we'll continue to make things in evolutionary steps. We won't make big new discoveries about the nature of consciousness. So if we're interested in the nature of consciousness, we need to expand it to exactly in the place where the yogis said don't pay much attention to. And in the process, I think we have the opportunity to learn something not only new for us, but also new for the yogis. Because, you see, the yogis, they didn't have theoretical concepts like we do. They didn't understand the nature of the physical world like we do. So we have the possibility of creating something really new by combining old wisdom with modern methods.
So, Dean, as you've pushed this envelope towards extending consciousness and realizing there's some limits to how far we can go, how has it changed your approach or your ideas about how you would approach this experimentally in your lab? You've been doing this kind of research for a long time. How did investigating these yogic traditions change where you might want to go in the future in your lab?
That's a fair question. One of the things that you see when you study the cities, and this is mentioned in the literature, is the difference between spontaneous psychic phenomena, including the effects that we study in the laboratory, as compared to what happens when somebody actually achieves one of the cities. So the cities, like if you have a city of telepathy or clairvoyance, it's not weak and sporadic and sometimes appears and sometimes doesn't. It's 100%. It's there. It's like an ordinary sense, and it's powerful. And so obviously I pay attention to that because it would be really nice if we can get somebody to do that in the laboratory. And yet we can't use somebody from the yogic tradition or one of the other traditions because they're told not to pay attention to it, or at least not to demonstrate these abilities. And I've already run up against that with very advanced meditators who, when I ask, can they do some of the cities, they just smile and they won't say anything else. So we're kind of stuck there. But what we can do and what we have been starting to do in my lab is to use every trick in the book that we can think of to optimize the conditions under which somebody can achieve higher reliability. And this includes things like the use of neurofeedback to get people's brain states into the right condition so that they can maintain this, for example, an alpha state where you're very highly alert, but you have no anxiety behind it. So that seems to be an important condition or state to be in of so-called effortless driving. So you can train people to get there, and you can train them fairly quickly using neurofeedback. We can use hypnosis to alter people's beliefs a little bit, because one of the blocks that we see in these phenomena is that you maintain enough doubt that you're basically self-defeating. Well, if you're susceptible to hypnosis, then that can be changed. You can change, at least momentarily, what you believe both consciously and even unconsciously. We can do tests looking at the difference between your conscious belief and your unconscious belief through what's called implicit testing. There are a variety of ways of doing experiments that reveal how you really feel, how you unconsciously feel about certain topics, including your belief that you'll be able to do something psychic in the lab. And if it turns out that you consciously say, yeah, I could do this, but unconsciously you're saying, I don't think I can do this. Well, we need to know that, because that would be a way of discriminating between somebody who's likely to do better than somebody else. So we're working down a list of ways that we know of optimizing or suspecting that it would optimize our ability to provide the right concentration, the right motivation, the right belief, the right practice, the right environment for doing the experiments, everything we can think of to see if we can start moving in the direction of the level of performance that is described in the cities as compared to what we normally see, which is sporadic and performance is buffeted all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's coming together in some of your current work?
Well, our first approach in this direction is in a mind-matter interaction experiment, which is not published yet, but will be soon, we hope. And what we did is during the experiment, the mind-matter interaction experiment, we also took 32-channel EEG measures, and we asked each participant to take a personality inventory called the Cloninger Temperament and Character Inventory. And this is an interesting personality test because it assumes that your temperament, your basic temperament, is driven by your biology, that the way that you approach the world in fundamental ways is driven by your genetic inheritance. And this was developed partially as a result of looking at personality similarities and temperament similarities among identical twins. And it holds up. And then your basic temperament is, according to this theory, is modulated by what they call character. And character is your history, how events in your life have shaped and changed your temperament. So the questionnaire that we give, it's 240 items. It comes out with different scales showing your temperament and your person and your character. We have the EEG measures, and we have information on how the people did on the mind-matter interaction task. And we look at the correlations among these different factors, and we're finding some very interesting things. And I'm not going to go into it in any detail because it's not published yet, but the upshot of it is that it gives us a better picture on what kinds of people do well in what kinds of brain states for these particular tasks. And that gives us a clue about both who to select and what kind of brain states to be in order to optimize performance.
You know, finally, Dr. Raden, I wanted to touch on one other topic that I don't think you talked a lot about. You've built a solid reputation as a scientist. People look to you for the integrity and the rigor you bring to your work. But you're also, whether you want to or not, have been pushed on the front lines of this worldview battle that's going on, where on one hand we have a culture that's built on materialism, really two kinds of materialism, both scientific materialism, the we are biological robots, life is meaningless, the universe is meaningless, and an economic materialism that just kind of tells us that he who dies with the most toys wins. And I'm wondering, given the extent to which we have to acknowledge we're just totally enmeshed in this paradigm, do you really think we can navigate out of it? I mean, you're kind of painting a picture for how we would do that with this book and with your body of research. But do you really think that's possible?
You mean, is it possible given the amount of inertia and economic investment in the status quo?
Economic, political, military, day-to-day, our technology, we are enmeshed in it. When we talk about transcending it, I wonder if it's a pipe dream, and two, if it's really something we even want.
Well, it's a very good question, and I think on alternate days, I'm optimistic and pessimistic. The inertia is gigantic. Many people are still questioning as to whether the climate change is real or not, even in the midst of extremely unusual weather. I live in Sonoma County in California, and yesterday in Sonoma County, there was the longest run of lightning strikes in the middle of the night, almost out of nowhere, for hours. It just stayed in one particular spot for hours, and it lit something like 20 or 30 fires. And people have lived in Sonoma County for their entire lives, including the newspaper reporting someone who's 80 years old, saying he had never even heard of anything like that before, happening anywhere. And it never happens to have lightning storms like this in Sonoma County. So we are faced almost daily now with extremely unusual weather patterns. And yet when we look at what's happening in politics, it's as though this is nothing. And it actually doesn't even matter what the cause is. What matters is that it become a topic of discussion, and well, what do we do about it?
Yeah, but that's really problematic, because if we look at climate and we look at it scientifically, it's just another rat's nest. I mean, the biggest news scientifically in climate has to do with both the UN governing body and NASA coming out and saying that in the last 17 years, there's been no global warming. So whether we're screwing up our environment to the extent that we think we are with CO2 gases, we can put that aside for a second and deal with, by the best measures we have, these models that we were all excited about a few years ago have totally failed us. They haven't predicted what we would expect to happen given the variables that have come into it. So I don't think it's any surprise that people they're stunned into inaction. I mean, which way should we go? Moreover, the whole global warming thing was sold to us wrapped up in a goofy carbon trading, multi-trillion dollar scam deal that it can't be separated from the science. So again, doesn't this point to how these things are enmeshed, how science is enmeshed with our politics and whatever else is driving us towards this future that someone is planning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where my pessimism arises from, that because of economic interests and because of people who have money and power wanting to maintain it, which means maintaining the status quo, it's unlikely that much will change at all. What does push change, at least within the scientific world, is new and exciting theories, because fortunately a lot of scientists are kind of like myself, and while we pay attention to what's going on in the world, what we're really driven by is curiosity about the natural world. And so if somebody comes along with something really cool and interesting, it attracts a lot of scientific attention, even though we don't actually know if there's a practical use for it now. If it turns out that something is developed that has a practical use, then it gains even more attention, because there are plenty of people out there who want to make money based on it. So when I'm optimistic, I'm thinking, well, if quantum biology continues in the direction it's going, then the plausibility case that could be made for a theoretical underpinning for psychic effects will continually get better. And then people will pay more attention to the data. And ultimately, it'll simply become one more interesting and curious thing that science can study. And in which case, it doesn't matter what's going on in the rest of the socio-political context. It's something that will just naturally be absorbed into science because it's something that's curious. Now, that said, certainly the topic is still quite taboo. It's very difficult for people to make a living in the academic world if they're interested in this topic. But historically, that's been true for other topics as well. And eventually, truth will out. And it's simply a matter of more struggle during the times when it's taboo. But, that could change. And it could change quickly.
Well, let's hope truth does win out. And if it does, I can bet you that Dr. Dean Radin will be at the tip of the spear. The book, again, is Supernormal: Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. Dr. Radin, it's been a great pleasure having you on Skeptico. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks again to Dr. Dean Radin for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of questions I might tee up as a result of this interview, and they both have to do with the idea of bringing psi to the lab. Something Dean Radin, of course, has done more to advance than just about anyone I can think of. So the first question has to do with this idea of psi being somewhat of a stepping stone along this continuum towards enlightenment, the enlightenment experience that so many people from so many different traditions talk about. You can hear me getting a little bit worked up there because it again just amazes me that we can just gloss over this experience that is so fundamentally profound across cultures, across times, this thing we call enlightenment, and yet we're just going to pretend it doesn't really exist because it doesn't fit into our paradigm. So the point is Dr. Radin on the right track in terms of bringing a scientific understanding of that process by looking at psi? What are your thoughts on his approach to that? That would be question number one. And question two is related, and that is, what is the best way to bring psi into the lab? Dr. Radin is pioneering a lot of this work, of course, but he's not the only one. What research do you think is most promising in the area of demonstrating psi phenomena under laboratory conditions? Should we be looking more towards people who've demonstrated these extraordinary abilities and are off the charts? Or should we look at how this phenomena manifests itself in the general population? Is telepathy the best path to pursue, or is it precognition or telekinesis or something else? Would be interesting to hear what your thoughts are on the path forward for psi research in the lab. So I'd love to hear from you on those topics. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. I love when you connect with us through the forum where a lot of people get together and exchange some interesting ideas. You can also leave a comment directly there on the website. And while you're there, of course, you can subscribe to Skeptico, download any of our over 200 previous shows, or connect with me via Facebook or an email. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. They're just piling up here as summer rolls on for me. I hope you'll stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.